We are the image of God. That is, we are his physical representatives so that we can rule over creation on his behalf.
The Bible is made for this. Like, it talks about supernatural entities that are real, that aren't imaginary. And I think the church has to wake up to this.
Do you think that whenever she came out of the water, that there was a demon came out of her?
It's like, I can understand that, because our human nature is to, you know, take the blessings that God gives us and then forget about them tomorrow.
There is an intelligence at war against them. And I think what I'm suggesting is that there are still intelligences that we're at war against.
I really like what Dr. Michael Heiser said a lot, is that God's desire is to dwell with mankind forever.
All of the nations in the world have been assigned a particular overseeing guardian to watch over them. But that in particular, the nation of Israel has been designated to be solely God's chosen nation.
The Word gave life to everything that was created, and his life brought light to everyone.
But our enemy has not laid down their arms. Their power is broken. Christ is King, the Lord of Lords, the God of Gods, mighty and awesome.
I was at one time the fastest sword driller in the county.
Hello, my friends, and welcome to the Two Trees Podcast. I'm John Dillon. I'm here without my usual friends because they're all off doing fun things, but I have the opportunity to speak to a professor of biblical studies at Eternity Bible College. He's the author of Paul and the Meaning of Scripture, a philosophical hermeneutic approach to Paul and his use of the Old Testament in Romans. But he's just put out a new book called The End of the World as You Know It, and why it's good news. So I'd like to welcome Matthew Halstead. Dr. Halstead, thank you for giving your time and being willing to come and to speak to us here at the Two Trees.
Hey, it's a real pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for the invitation, and I look forward to this fun conversation.
So many of you are probably familiar with him because he has a connection to the Awakening School of Theology, teaches one of the courses there. How did they rope you into that? Were you just, you know, floating around and you thought, you know what, I need more time in Florida. I think I'm going to go over there and teach a course. How did that come about?
Well, I have to say, I always need more time in Florida. So that part is definitely true. But yeah, just through just conversation. So my school, Eternity Bible College and Awakening, we have a formal partnership for like some of our certificate programs and whatnot. And so just through, you know, that partnership and that conversation, of course, I've had, you know, conversations before with the folks at Awakening and some connection that way. So, I don't actually remember all of the details of how I got involved with that, but, it seems like, yeah, I think it was through our partnership, actually. We were just kind of contemplating, you know, what courses, we needed, and then they needed this course too, I guess. So,
Well, you also have a really great podcast called The Bible Unmuted, and you guys can find it at just about any podcast place. He's done a lot of interviews. You're probably familiar with his work, and you have put out a topic that interests a lot of people, but also it's kind of one of those topics you're not supposed to talk about at the Christian dinner table because it's, you know, politics and end times, right? It's that view of everyone has their pet theory, and if you disagree with all that I think about this, I will have to burn you as a heretic. And when I read your book, I was so blessed because it comes across in such a helpful, informative, it's packed with useful stuff. Every chapter I felt like was so on point, but it also comes across so humble that you're not coming out and saying, well, listen, I've cracked the code, everyone must now adopt my new way of looking at this. It really was a push to understand, where did this book come from? Where did the book of Revelation come from? Who wrote it? And what did the people who read this book originally think? And so I was refreshed by it because Christian history is packed with groups of people who were so confident they understood it, they put out the date, you know, 19, whatever. Everybody moved to the hills. You know, this is happening. Edgar Wisent's book, it's infamous at this point, The 88 Reasons That Christ Is Returning in 1988. And that resulted in a whole lot of baptisms in the area that I'm ministering in. And so it made a big, splash in the local community here. But it also left a lot of, I don't say this nicely, a lot of trauma, because people bought so deeply into the system that they suddenly thought, well, if this isn't true, what else isn't true? And their look of the Bible really was shaken, because they had placed their interpretation of the book of Revelation so aggressively forward that they couldn't distinguish it at times from the deity of Jesus or inspiration. And so I love the title of your book, Why It's Good News. And I just want you to introduce yourself. Tell us a little bit about who you are and why you wrote this book.
Yeah, so I teach biblical studies at Eternity Bible College, and I've been teaching with them in some capacity since 2016. So I guess that's about 8 years now. So very, very much thankful for my students, all my colleagues. It's just a great environment to be teaching in. And so that's what I do full time as a job. And as you mentioned, I have a podcast called The Bible Unmuted, and we do long form studies, going through Romans and finishing that up. And I, of course, do interviews, quite a bit of interviews actually, and with scholars and whatnot. So it's always fun to get to dialogue with folks on that medium in that way. The most important thing about me is I'm a husband and a father. Like, I've been married for 17 years. We have four wonderful kiddos, the ages of which range from 15 and a half, because my oldest just got a permit, so that's pretty cool. So 15 to 6 now, so four kiddos, and so it's always such a fun, busy time at the Halstead house. So it's a blast. And I've written a couple of books. The first was Paul and the Meaning of Scripture, which is a study on Paul's use of the Old Testament in the book of Romans. And then this new book came out, I guess, about a week ago, February 7th, as of this recording or so. And how I wrote that book was interesting. I didn't actually set out to write a book on eschatology. What happened was, in 2020, when we were at the height of a lot of cultural questions, specifically around the COVID pandemic and all the questions regarding health emergencies and things like that. We were at the height of all of this. And my wife and I, you know, being on social media, saw a lot of different things being said about COVID and the vaccine in particular with respect to end times passages from Scripture. And everybody was talking about COVID, and, you know, we really didn't know what it was or the effects of that it would have upon people. And so there were just lots of questions, much fear.
Yeah.
And everybody, Christians and non-Christians, were talking about it. But what was particularly interesting is that we saw a lot of Christians talking about that with respect to the Bible, right? And so what ended up happening was people were taking end times passages, many of which came from Revelation, the Mark of the Beast, you know, Revelation 13. And they were pairing it with and speculating about how that might be related to the COVID vaccine. And so and these sorts of speculations were really just completely off base. And the fear was that, you know, I had was, man, I can't think of any scholar who actually would say these sorts of things that I'm seeing on social media. And I felt like many people were becoming terrified by the things that they were reading, because many of these social media posts were, you know, just making the rounds. And so my wife was like, you know, hey, you should really post a response to these sorts of things being said. And I was apprehensive at first, because, you know, I don't know how healthy it is to weigh in on these sorts of things. But the older I get, the more I conclude that social media is not the best place to have deep, meaningful conversations.
What?
Right. Yeah.
That's crazy. No, it's absolutely true. I have yet to have a meaningful, deep conversation in the comments of anything. And that's, I mean, I would like to. Maybe one day it will, but normally it's, it's mean out there.
Yeah, and so I was really apprehensive in light of that. On the other end of the spectrum, though, it was like, well, okay, if we don't have decent content out there, then this other bad content's going to rule the day, and I don't really want that. So my wife, you know, was telling me, hey, you know, you should really put content out there that makes sense, you know? And so I was like, well, okay, I'll do it. So I got on my iPhone's app, Notes app, and started just writing up something. I'd just post to Facebook or something. And I did, I wrote it up, and it resonated. I posted it. It resonated with a lot of people, and they, it was shared pretty widely. And I had a friend who was an editor of the Logos Academic blog. That's what it was called at the time. And it was for pastors and, you know, people in the church, scholars and stuff like that. And so he said, hey, would you mind if I put that on our blog? And I said, sure, of course. So that became an article on their blog. And that article was widely read. I mean, I don't know if this is the case, but at that time or not too long after that, it was the most widely read article on their website or on that Logos Academic blog. And so I wrote a follow-up article to that. And then after that, conversations began about, hey, could you write a book? You know, would you be interested in this? And then about a year after that is when I started writing the book. And so, that's it was just kind of interesting. It just started with, a lonely little iPhone Notes app. and so that's the genesis of the book. And I wrote it up and added more stuff to it. And you know, we were talking about social media. It's really not the best place to have conversations, but it actually is a good place to post content, right? And to put food for thought into people's minds and so forth. And so I have no regrets at all doing that, because I think you know, if you don't have good voices out there, good content, then the bad content will rule the day. And so that's sort of the genesis of it all.
No, I think that's pretty wise. I think the missing part on social media really is relationships. It's like one person says something and then everyone storms in to yell an opinion and then disappear. And that gives, I mean, there's just, it's not nice. I've experienced the negative and so have you. But I think that the Lord gave us a wonderful gift through your writings here. It's been very helpful for me. And I think the more, just as a pastor speaking, it can be very hard to find content that can be given to the layperson and not just drown them in the academic jargon or in these two pages are in Greek and you have to understand what's going on. And so I really loved how I would have no problem giving your book to anybody and they could understand it and think about it. And it didn't come across as preachy. It came across as, this is what I know, and I'm someone who does know. And so this isn't just some pastor from someplace like me with an opinion. This is someone who's been studying this, and this is what you do for a living. And so the more bridges I think can be built from the academy to the pulpit, the better our job as pastors becomes, and the easier it becomes to find good information. And so if you've got more notes apps lurking in the back of your iPhone, go ahead and publish those immediately.
Thank you so much. And thank you for the kind words. It does mean a lot to me. It's very encouraging to me. And that was my goal, is I wanted to write a book that it could be placed in the hands of anybody interested in the topic, right? And I wanted to try to balance it out to be different from, you know, what we might call modern prophecy teaching, that kind of stuff, and where there's no real research done, you know, in those books. And I didn't want to do that. But I also didn't want it to be like academic, where you had to go learn like two different dead languages to even access the material. And so what I try to do is just say what I wanted to say in everyday plain English, but have a good amount of resources in say the footnotes, where if people wanted to dig deeper, I've given you the tools to go do your research in all the articles that I cite or the books that I cite. And then, but you don't have, the cool thing is you don't have to do that. Like it's all there in the text. You could ignore the footnotes and go right through it. Or you could run a mile deep and go into some of the peer-reviewed literature, you know, that I cite. And I think you're right, lastly, is to say, look, we need to understand the role of the academy, okay, academic writing and such, and the work of scholars and so forth. The fact of the matter is this: scholarship, Christian scholarship, exists for the church. Christian scholarship is a servant to the church, right? And if we're not, you know, building those bridges back to the pew, then what's the point of, you know, Christian scholarship if it's not building up the church? So we do need those inroads. And you know, I think of people like Mike Heiser, who I think perfected that idea. I've always had this passion to you know, bridge the academy and the church. It's just been a passion of mine for a long time. But seeing it play out so effectively in like the ministry of Mike Heiser as an example, like that just spurs me on. It was such a, his work was such a fuel for me to continue this idea. You know, and you know, time will tell if this book is effective in that regard. But at least that's my goal. That was my my hope for this book, is that it would help people, help Christians, and give them some resources to dig further if they so chose.
Well, I think the pastors out there should dig into the footnotes because they're fun. You gave us a lot of, because sometimes you just don't know where to look. Where should I go? I mean, do I Google prophecy on, and Lord knows where you'll end up if that's what you do. And so it's refreshing. I really enjoyed it. But I think you succeeded in capturing a conversation starter about ideas that pastors can say, okay, I may not completely agree with this idea or that idea, but now let's talk about this big idea that he's got introduced to me here in the topic. And it came across so well. And one of those topics that I think every pastor out there or every Sunday school teacher or Bible student should recognize is that when you are studying a book of the Bible, to remember that the content and the context, the historical background of that book really matter. And so when you're reading, for instance, 1 Corinthians or, I don't know, Thessalonians, you want to know, what was Paul up to when this was going on? Is this one of the prison epistles? Is this something he wrote, you know, from Philippi? Or what's going on? And you then want to know, well, what about that city? What about that place? And you dig into the context. The problem has been for me that the context of Revelation has always been presented as future. And so there's not really much to dig into, as much as speculation, you know, is this the mark of the beast? Or I know a lady that wouldn't get a Kroger card because she was convinced that Kroger card, which is a grocery shop around us, that was bringing in the beast. You know, it may not be the mark of the beast, but it might be the mark of the beast. And so you got to be careful. And there's just so much fear based about this that most people, when they read the book of Revelation, except for the ending, which is very nice, they come away afraid of what's coming or of what's going on. And knowing the background of the book, what was John doing? Where was he going? And who are these churches that he's writing to? Remembering that this is a letter, I think is a great place to start. So would you just kind of walk us through, and you do a great job of this in your book, and so obviously he's not going to tell you everything in the interview that he's going to tell you in the book, so calm down out there. He's going to, I hope, talk to you about the why he thinks this is important, and I do too. Why should we view this as a letter? And how will that help our study?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it is a section of my book where I talk about the different genres of Revelation. And one of which is that Revelation is an epistle, or it's a letter, we would say. And the reason why it's important to come to terms with that is really, well, two reasons. First is that Revelation says it is a letter, right? So we need to get our cues from the text. If it has the hallmarks of a letter, then we should flip that light on and say, okay, it's a letter. Let's read it as a letter. If we don't do that, then I fear we end up bringing different sorts of assumptions to Revelation. So, for example, like we might think that it's a theology book on the future, right? That John sat down to tell us all about the future. Not the first century future only, but our 21st century future. And then, so we immediately think that it has some sort of Nostradamus sort of atmosphere to it or feel to it. And so, you know, because we've assumed it's just a theology book on the future or the final events or something. But actually, when you come back and you're like, okay, wait, this actually says it's a letter. And then, okay, we're going to deal with that. Now, by dealing with that fact, we need to ask ourselves another question. What does it mean for this text to be a letter? What would that entail? What sorts of conclusions would follow from that fact? Well, it's easy, actually, because once you say Revelation is a letter, is the moment that you admit that it had to have been, in some ways, understandable to its first century recipients. Okay? And in fact, when you read Revelation, not only does it assume that its original readers would understand its words, okay, but it also expects them to obey the words. And Craig Keener, in his Revelation commentary, he says, look, Revelation, in order to have been obeyed, it had to have been discernible. You know, they would have had to have understood what it was saying in order to obey it. That doesn't mean, of course, that there's no mystery there. That doesn't mean, of course, that the first century Christians exhausted the mystery of this text. Not at all. But it does mean on many levels that it was understandable. And so you actually, so once you do that, you're like, okay, you're going to read the text differently. So for instance, you'll notice in Revelation 13 where John says that the person with wisdom, let the person with wisdom understand this whole mark of the beast thing. So he's assuming that somebody with wisdom, with a little insight, could crack this quote unquote code, right? If we could put it that way. It's a code to us, but I don't suspect it was that much of a code to them. Not in the ways that we think, at least. But anyway, so you begin to notice, oh, wow, so John seems to hint that they can know what this stuff is about. The other thing is, once you say that this is a letter, is the minute you also admit that you need to look into the situation of the letter. So if there's a letter written to these seven churches, you know, by a guy who is in exile on an island called Patmos, you immediately have to say, okay, well, you know, why does he think he needs to write this letter? And why does he think he needs to write this letter to those churches? I mean, the guy's in exile, right? There's a big situation here. So what is that situation? You know, what's motivating John to write these letters? And furthermore, what would motivate the seven churches to actually take the time to read them? And not only that, but to pass these letters along to others. And so that means as soon as you say it's a letter, you have to inquire into the situation of the seven churches, which means you're going to have to do some historical inquiry, some historical investigation. What was going on in the first century in the Roman province of Asia, which is where these seven churches were?
Right.
And these seven churches, moreover, they are real churches. Like, they had real geographical locations, you know, Ephesus, Thyatira, etc. I mean, you have archaeological findings in this area that might bear some aid in helping us to understand the context of these cities. And my thesis is, look, when you look into the historical background, that sets the stage for understanding the text of Revelation. So if you view the situation as, I don't know, like a stage play, before you can have the characters do anything meaningful on the stage, you need a stage, right? You need the stage and you got to put the props in place. Otherwise, all you have is a text, a screenplay, or whatever. But we want the screenplay to come alive, and that requires props, that requires a stage, that requires lighting, that requires backdrops, and all these sorts of things to make that meaningful, to understand. And so that's what I'm trying to do in this book, is to, you know, not only help people play chess, but help them to see how to set up the chess pieces so that they can play chess effectively.
I think that makes a ton of sense, especially because of the wild vividness of so much of the Book of Revelation and how it's captivated artists and the imagination of Christians for a very long time, that each of our different traditions of Christianity has assumptions that we bring into these texts. And so then to go back to a starting point where we can agree, and that's to say, these were real people, and this is really in the Bible, and God wants us to dig into this, is it just makes sense to me. But it's so easy to view, okay, this is the part to the letters or the churches And, you know, that's nice. Maybe this is something to do with me, if I can figure out some way to read me into this. But ultimately, let's get to the good part where, like, dragons pop up and beasts erupting out of the sea. And many people are just really shocked to read these things because it's so wildly different from the pastoral epistles. Like you read 1 Peter or James and those sorts of things, that the general epistles, it just is so, whoa, where did that come from? And then to understand that, to read Revelation, it might help you to read Joel, or it might help you to have read Zechariah, because this is part of a genre. There is literature about this. And so we call that apocalyptic literature. And apocalyptic, to most people, means, you know, the end of the world. It's a movie about something. It's this horrible end of the world kind of a thing. But there is a genre of literature called apocalyptic literature. And would you just kind of walk us through what smart people mean when they're saying apocalyptic literature? Is it always about the end of the world? What is it?
That's a great question. So when I think, you know, growing up or whatever, when I heard the word apocalyptic, I immediately thought mushroom cloud. Like, that's the image that would come up, or, you know, a post, you know, nuclear explosion sort of world or whatever. But in reality, the Greek word behind apocalypse actually just means to reveal, to, you know, disclose something that was previously revealed, to open up, to pull back the curtains, so to speak, so that you could see what's really going on behind the stage. And you're correct. Scholars identify, and there's debates, of course, about apocalyptic genre, and there are lots of different views on these sorts of things. But the consensus is that we might say that there is a genre, quote unquote, of, you know, quote unquote apocalyptic, you know, because you see you see similarities between these types of writings. You know, you might look at First Enoch, you might look at Revelation, John's letters to the churches. You know, you see some of these elements in Ezekiel, in Matthew 24, you know, and whatnot. You have types of writing that are highly symbolic. You have types of writing that are using symbols to speak of realities that normal language, you know, is incapable of, right? Mm. And so, like in Daniel, you have these images of the beast, or sorry, four beasts in Daniel chapter 7. And these beasts represent kingdoms. And so, which is bears a lot of similarities to John's beast in Revelation 13, Revelation 17. And so the idea behind apocalyptic literature is it would be reductionist to say it's all about the future. Much like the word prophecy, like, it would be reductionist to say that it's just all about the future. In reality, what apocalyptic is meant to do is to help God's people see reality in the present in a different perspective. And not only the present, but also the past, to be able to look behind you and say, okay, so that's what was really going on. Like, I thought we were being defeated, but as it turns out, this is all part of God's plan, right? Mm. And so I can look at history afresh. And I can also look at my present situation and say, you know what? It looks really rough. It looks like this dragon is winning the day. But as it turns out, my faith in the Lamb will actually sustain me, and the Lamb will actually defeat the beast or whatever. But it also does have a future impact. Like, I'm not suggesting that it has nothing to do with the future, but it just can't be reduced down to the future, because apocalyptic, if you just look at Revelation, you know, which actually starts off by saying the apocalypse of Jesus Christ, the revelation of Jesus Christ. It's meant to give the people of the first century hope for tomorrow. Like, there is a future aspect to it. And it's timeless, in fact. Like, it gives us hope today. It'll give us hope tomorrow. It's given us hope in the past. And so I don't like to point everything to the future. I think that's completely reductionistic. And so I think a good way to think of apocalyptic literature is to say it's revealing reality from God's perspective. And he wants us to have his perspective over the situation that we find ourselves in.
So one of the interesting parts of Revelation going along with what you just mentioned is the Bible seems to talk about this battle or rivalry between Babylon and Jerusalem, that you have this idea of Babylon becomes more than just the city where the people went into exile, more than just the place where the tower was built. Would you just walk us through a little bit? Why does the Apostle John, or why did God choose? I mean, obviously you're not speaking for God, but why do you think Babylon becomes this shorthand for the kingdom of darkness?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we know, and scholars seem to be in agreement here, is that the word Babylon, or the term Babylon in Revelation, is an epithet or a stand-in word for Rome, okay, the Roman Empire. And the reason that seems to be the case is because there were some similarities between the Babylonian Empire and the Roman Empire of John's day. So just for example, the Babylonian Empire, destroyed the temple at Jerusalem, okay? Mm. And if you take a late date, to the book of Revelation, you might say, well, that's perhaps a reason why Rome's called Babylon because Rome destroyed the temple in AD 70, right? And some people will actually use that as sort of a proof to say, this is probably why Revelation was written at a later date or whatever. We don't have to get into all those sorts of debates. But the idea is that there's some radical similarities between Babylon and the Roman Empire. And so that's why, arguably, the Roman Empire takes on this Babylonian-esque appearance, okay? And I think it's actually very indicative of a lot of things is like, words are very powerful. When you describe somebody as something, that's meant to influence the way you interpret that something. So by the early Christians and early Jews calling Rome Babylon, what they're essentially saying is that it's a godless empire, right? We've seen this before. God's going to get us through this, right? So that would explain that idea of Babylon is definitely, in my opinion, and then the opinion of the vast majority of scholars is to say that this is definitely Rome, okay? So we have to kind of root it in that language. You know, there was just lots of similarities in terms of brutality, the exile, the oppression of God's people. And I think that's actually a big part of Revelation is that, God's people, these early Christians living in Asia, were always under the threat of persecution and social ostracization. I think it's important here not to overstate the case, though, because there's no evidence to suggest historically that, there was like this massive empire-wide persecution of Christians. I don't think that's what's going on in Revelation. I mean, you do have deep persecution of Christians in the first century. I mean, we're thinking of like Nero, right? But that seems to, according to the scholarship, seems to be relegated to a local area in Rome. Okay, it's not like empire-wide. And it was, really because Nero was just an evil, despicable person and it was very sporadic, I think is the word that sometimes people use, sporadic persecution. And so we're not suggesting that there was like this massive empire-wide persecution of Christians. There's just no evidence to support that. But what there is evidence to support is that to have been a Christian in the first century, particularly in a place like Asia, the province of Asia, which is modern-day Turkey, that it would have been very difficult to have been faithful as a Christian to Christ in that sort of world. And there was definitely many opportunities to be socially ostracized economically, even. And I think that's a very big point to make with respect to, say, the Mark of the Beast stuff. Here I am rambling. I forget your initial question.
No. You got me interested. How would being a Christian have impacted them economically?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Okay, so we kind of need to back up a little bit because I think we need to understand that being a Christian...
When somebody you're interviewing says, not only do I have something to say about that, I have a lot to say about that. Let's back up. Keep going.
Yeah. So the early Christian movement was definitely an early, a first century Jewish movement, right? I don't like to separate Christianity from Judaism in that sense. Like, they would not, early Christians would not have seen themselves as like starting a new religion or anything like that, right? The whole category of religion is largely a modern construct that would be anachronistic to impose back on a first century person. So anyway, so we need to place this into the context of an early Jewish movement, a messianic movement. And we know that Jews, of course, really struggled in many different ways with Roman and Greek domination. You know, you could read the book of First Maccabees. Highly recommend everybody read that for some good background material. To give you some context on the Hellenism, how Hellenism and Greek culture was in many ways imposed violently upon Jewish people. First Maccabees, Second Maccabees, those are really helpful. But then when Rome comes along, there's some struggles here too, right? And what ends up happening though is, so Jewish people in the Jewish establishment largely had an exemption. You didn't have to pray to Caesar, right? The Jews would not do that. And from my understanding, the Roman Empire was like, okay, look, we don't really want war, you know, and so we want to keep peace, Pax Romana, as best as possible here. And so so the Jews actually had an exemption. They did not have to worship Caesar. What they had to do, though, and what they agreed to do was to pray for Caesar. You know, they had no problem doing that because, you know, Jeremiah even talks about how pray for the good of the city. So the Jews had textual precedence for how to relate to an empire in this sense. So they were exempted. And so if early Christianity was part of that Jewish movement, then early Christians would initially have been seen as exempted from, you know, worshiping Caesar and whatnot. Now, the problem, though, becomes very acute whenever Jews and Christians really begin to struggle to exist together, right? With respect to their differing convictions about the messianic status of Jesus of Nazareth.
Sure.
And so you have these instances where there's lots of disputes. And so at some point, you know, there is an exodus, if you will. There is a separation between early Christian worship and Jewish, you know, worship practices, such that early Christians become to be seen as a different sort of institution. And moreover, when you know early Christians, even in the Jewish synagogue, you had Gentiles, a Gentile activity, right? You know, the Gentiles would be donors of and help synagogues and whatnot. So, but as early Christianity really began to spread, and early Christianity began to bring in Gentiles into their fold without requiring them to be circumcised, like that you could be a Gentile and be a Christian without having to do Jewish going through the Jewish rites. That really began to be seen as, okay, this is not a Jewish movement, because in some churches it might be exclusively Gentile Christians. Okay, now this brings up a political situation such that the Roman Empire, you know, will say, okay, well, you're a different movement altogether, so you need to worship Caesar, right? And if you don't, then there are deep consequences for this. And we have to understand that the Roman worldview was such that from my understanding, they didn't really have a problem with different religions. Like, the Roman system had no problem with, you know, whatever you wanted to believe, provided that you also, you know, worshiped the other gods, that you also worshiped Caesar or paid homage to him, and that you worshiped Zeus or Jupiter or whatever. You needed to be a pluralist in that sense. And of course, Christians could not do that. You know, that it was Jesus alone, that sort of idea. And so this is where the problem really gets home, is that Christians, because they are now outside of the synagogue and they don't really carry the same exemption, their way of life and worship is deeply threatened. You couple that reality with what's going on in Asia. We know that the province of Asia, modern-day Turkey, was a Greek-speaking area of the empire. It held the fourth largest city in the empire, namely Ephesus. Goodness, it escapes me. I think Ephesus probably had like 250,000 people at one time. Whoa. Or during that era. And it was a pretty big city at the time, right? And so, and I think Rome, the city of Rome, had 1 million. So I think that made Ephesus the fourth largest in the ancient world at that time, in the empire at least. And So it was a very important place, but it was also a very important place with respect to what is known as the imperial cult. This is the reality that, let me back up again. Rome had a practice of deifying its emperors after the emperor died. Okay, but there was a process for that. Like the Roman Senate had to approve of it and vote on it and all of that. So you never did that though until the emperor died. So when Julius Caesar died, he was later deified. And I forget the date of that. But anyway, he was deified. And his adopted son, Octavian, who we know as Augustus Caesar, if your dad is deified as a god, then you get to be called a son of a god, right? Or son of a divine one or something like that. And so you while you were alive, I mean, you weren't deified while you were alive, but there were these sorts of terms that you could apply to yourself and that was applied to you. So what was interesting though is in the Western part of the empire in Rome, you didn't deify a living emperor. That was considered weird, right? And ugly or whatever. But in the Eastern parts of the empire, deification seems to have been a practice that Rome tolerated, right? And so in places like Asia, you know, it's a Greek-speaking place, and the Greeks, they didn't really have that same problem with deifying a living ruler. So that it was like no problem for them. Like they would deify a ruler. And so what would end up happening, long story short, is temples would be built in places like Ephesus and Smyrna and Pergamum, where, and these were like province-sponsored temples, provincial temples. And these temples would be for the worship of the Greek goddess Roma, or the Caesar's family. And so these were places throughout the first century in Asia. We know that, I mean, these imperial cults had their own, I think, choir, kids choir or whatever. People would join choirs and they would, you know, sing their praises to the emperor's family and whatnot. And in the city of Rome, the goddess would be worshipped as well. Now, why this is important is because we as 21st century Western, well, I'm assuming most listeners here are maybe American or whatever, but we tend to separate life from religion. You know, religion is what you do on a Sunday, right? And every other day is just sort of its own thing. In the ancient world, that was a foreign concept. There was no separation of religion or worship from your daily activities. So if you were part of a trade guild, and you know, we think of trade unions today, but trade guilds were very important, especially actually archaeology, I think, shows us in Thyatira, the city of Thyatira, one of the seven churches, that was a place where there were lots of trade guilds. And so you would join a trade guild because you wanted some economic security. It was good to be part if you were a mason or whatever, some sort of, you had a trade, you joined these groups for obvious reasons. But these groups had patron deities, okay? And it would be probably customary to pay homage to these deities either through sacrificing food or dedicating food to the idols or whatever before you would have your trade meetings or whatever. Hmm. Well, Christians couldn't be part of those things for obvious reasons. They would have to be exempt. But here's the thing. If you didn't pay homage to the deity, in that world, you were considered a threat not just to yourself, but to society, because you might make the gods angry if you're not paying homage to them. Hmm. And so it was important for Roman pagans to, you know, ostracize these deviants, these social deviants called Christians, because they were a threat to the stability of the world. Hmm. And so you had to ostracize them to get rid of that threat so the gods wouldn't be angry with you. And so this is that social situation that early Christians in Asia probably found themselves in, is that if you wanted to have some economic security, if you wanted to buy and sell, we might say, then you might need to participate in the ways of what John calls the beast, which is clearly a reference to Rome. And so there are many ways that you could sell yourself over to the beast if you wanted to, and the ways of the beast, for economic security. And if you didn't, if you didn't choose to worship the images of the beast, i.e. the gods or whatever, then you were going to die, or some, maybe not death, but you would be ostracized. One last thing I'd say is when you look at the beast and that imagery and the mark of the beast, it's interesting because in the text you'll notice that the mark of the beast stuff is very closely related to worshiping the image of the beast. They're often paired together in the text. And we do have evidence outside the Bible for the Caesar, or a couple of the Caesars, being called a beast. We see this in different writings and whatnot. And also we have in the Roman governor Pliny, who was the governor of a nearby province of Asia, not too far from these churches, where he's writing to the Emperor Trajan and he says, hey, we've got these Christians. I'm not sure how to really deal with them, but look, I'm trying to make them worship your image. And if they don't, then they need to die, right? How do you want me to handle this weird situation? And people can go read this online. It's one of Pliny's letters to Trajan. And so there you have two things. I think some historical data that we have data that shows that a couple of the Caesars were associated with the word beast or the concept of a beast. And then we have another situation where, Christians are being forced at the point of death to worship the image of a Caesar. So these are the categories of that social environment, the context, that I think are actually probably pretty important for how we understand this text. It gives it a little bit of meaning. Like, it helps set the stage I was talking about,
yeah,
so that these players can come on the stage and we can understand what they're saying. That's a lot of information there, but
good information.
But it gives a little bit about background, yeah.
Which makes a ton of sense, though, that a group of people reading this book wouldn't have been like, wow, none of this makes any sense at all. We have no way to understand what John is talking about here. There would have been an immediate understanding of, oh, this is like what we're going through. And it's also like what we're going through today as Christians. There is a very real element in which loyalty to our Lord is going to make you stand out and not be able to fully embrace the cultures that are around us. And I have no idea where all of our listeners are. I'm always surprised. Apparently they speak English, because I don't speak any of these other languages that are common where they're at. But we hear from our listeners all the time things that are just shocking to me, that I take for granted living in Ohio, that they're really having to cope with a lot of the things that the book of Revelation is saying. You know what? Not only are you dealing with this, but Christians have always been dealing with this, because we're at war against sin, against a world that doesn't accept Christ as our Lord and Savior. And so I really loved that you didn't simply point me to and say, well, just wait and see how this shakes out. But you can say, hey, John, he knew what he was talking about. There's something in history that will help you understand what's being talked about here. And I wanted to get into another topic. It's not really another topic. It's on the same topic. And it involved a trip to the gas station I had recently. I ordered, I got gas and I paid with my debit card at the gas pump, which is something you do here. And then I went inside to get some, I think like a pop and some food, but it's not soda, it's pop, just in case anyone was curious about that out here. But I'm there and my total comes up to $6.66. And the registrar, the lady working the register, about had a conniption. She was, you're going to have to buy something else, or you can't have one. She was not going to check me out with the $6.66, because to her, this is a magic number of evil. Is that something that we should be worried about when our totals come up to $6.66, or if you're you get a raise that's 666. Like, how would you advise us to look at this? Is it the magic evil number, or what exactly is John talking about?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's these sorts of things that I think really pique my interest, because they're kind of funny in some respects. I know my wife was telling me the other day, or this was a year or two ago, I guess, but on her driver's license, there were a series of 3 sixes and 1 point on the driver's license. She's like, oh no, that's so funny, you know? And she thought I'd get a kick out of that. And it is kind of funny, but you know, there are a lot of people when they see that, like, it's not funny, right? This is actually important to them. And they're like, wow, did I accidentally take the mark of the beast here? You know, is that kind of the thing? The thing I would say is, well, there are a few things. I talk about this in the book where I say you can't accidentally take the mark of the beast. That's just not the way that functions in the text.
Oh, if to I could me, highlight on my that reading, to everybody that, oh man, you cannot accidentally take the mark of the beast. Please quit telling me that someone so
yeah.
accidentally. Go ahead, go ahead.
Yeah, that's it's a very important thing, and I think it really does free people up who actually fear that, because there's so many people who fear that. And the way I explain it is to say, look, when you look at the way the mark of the beast is functioning in Revelation, you see that it's more of an identification marker. In other words, it doesn't like make you evil. It just identifies you as already evil. You know, it's what marks you out as that thing, right? You're a worshiper. Remember how I said the mark of the beast is associated with the worship of the image of the beast? Well, worship is an act of volition. Like, you can't force somebody to worship, right? It's an act of the will. And so we need to retain that association that the mark of the beast and having the mark is tantamount to being a willing participant in the ways of the beast. And these Christians, sincere followers of Jesus, who are deathly afraid of this, have no reason to be afraid of it, because they are sincere followers of Jesus. They're not sincere followers of the beast. Now, the moment they become, you know, God forbid, a sincere follower of Satan, then we have a different conversation to have, but that's not what sincere Christians are even interested in. So they have nothing to fear. There's nothing to worry in that respect. A couple of things here as well is that when we study the mark of the beast and we think about it, you can't do that in isolation, because the mark of the beast seems to be a parallel to another mark that's mentioned in Revelation. So for example, in Revelation 13, verses 16, 17, and 18, you have the mark of the beast. But in the very next verse, Revelation 14, verse 1, and those verses that follow, you have a discussion about what is known as the seal of the Lamb, which I think very helpfully Craig Keener calls the mark of the Lamb, and many people call it the mark of the Lamb. And I like that because it's a parallel to the mark of the beast. John wants us to see these as two different identity markers, okay, where you are identified as being one or the other. You're a servant of one or the other. And there's actually an important thing to make, observation to make here as well. John is not the first person to talk about marks on the body of a Christian or a person. So if you go to Ezekiel chapter 9, there's a place here where God marks, he tells his angels to mark out the righteous people so that they will be marked exempt from the judgment that's going to come upon the temple and stuff. And so this angel comes and marks these people. And I think that's a very important piece. These are marks that identify them as righteous, right? Which seems to be the idea in Revelation 14, marks that identify a person as righteous. And then the idea, though, is that the mark of the beast is an identifier of marking out someone who is unrighteous, someone who hates Jesus, who hates God, and so forth. And so that's where I would begin. As to your question about is 666 a magic number of that sort, I think that totally would not be the way to see it. Because what's interesting here is that it's actually 666. I mean, that's a different number than three sixes, right? And so that's an important point to make. But also, it's not the only number that's associated with the mark of the beast. We have extant in other manuscripts this idea that the mark of the beast, the number of the beast, is not 666, it's 616. So I think that's a really interesting. So there's actually two numbers that in church tradition that are associated with the beast's mark. More than likely, I get into this a little bit in my book, as I recall, but the idea is that, let me just kind of back up just a bit here. In the ancient world, you had a practice called gematria, and that was a pretty common thing to practice. And let me explain what that is. In a language like Greek, you did not have separate scripts, separate ways of writing out numbers. Okay, so like in English, we have a script, you know, for writing words, and then which is based on the Latin script. But then we pull in Arabic number systems for our numbers, right? So they're different. And if you notice like Roman numerals. I mean, everybody learned how to read Roman numerals when they were in middle school, and it was a terrible thing to learn, at least from my experience. But
it's training
those are
for
actually
Super Bowls is what it is. It's how you know what Super Bowl you're watching.
That's actually true. But even I was watching the Super Bowl, like, I have to mentally think, okay, L V, you know, like, I'm having to like process this. It's an act of code breaking. But those are you know, letters, right? Right, and they use double purpose. Well, so we just in English, if you speak and write in English, we don't have that issue, which is super helpful, I think. But in many languages, you don't have that. So what you'd have to do to use numbers is to reuse letters. And each letter of the alphabet would have a numerical value. So if you take Greek, the first letter in Greek is alpha, followed by beta, alpha, alpha, beta, gamma, and so forth. And in each of those letters would have a corresponding number. Like alpha would be 1, beta 2, and so forth. And just depending on the letter used would determine the number that you would get. In the ancient world, there was sometimes people who, instead of saying a person's name, they would say the number of the person's name. And sometimes it could be a joke, right? Joking about somebody. And we actually have evidence of this. I think and I don't remember the reference or even the exact quote, but I think there was a quote where, like, I guess graffiti on a wall or something, inscriptions where it said, so-and-so loves the woman whose number is, and he would list the number, right? It just sort of like, you know, the heart on the tree that we do for our Valentine and so forth, you know. They would do those sorts of things except use numbers. And so what John is doing is just practicing gematria. He's just kind of encoding, as it were, the name of the person he's thinking of, or the thing, the entity he's thinking of, and he's just giving it a number. And what's interesting is many scholars have concluded that that probably has something to do with Nero, because if you take Nero's name in Greek, Neron Kaiser, and it all depends on how you spell his name and what names you use, but if you used Neron Kaiser, Nero Caesar, and you transliterate that into Hebrew and you use the Hebrew numbers there, then you get 666, okay? That's the number that comes up. Now, what's interesting is if you spell Nero's name differently, if you don't say Neron Kaiser, but you say Nero Kaiser, you just drop one letter, then you get the number 616, which interestingly, perhaps by coincidence, perhaps not, that's the other number that's in some of our ancient manuscripts on Revelation. So you have two numbers, 666, 616. It has nothing to do with it being a magic number or a cursed number in that sense. It's just a number that has an identifier, perhaps of Nero. But again, gematria is, it all depends on how you spell a person's name, you know, and then, you know, especially for the Caesars, they had sometimes very long names, you know, titles and so forth. Which ones do you use? And that's kind of the mystery here is, which creates a lot of speculation. But if you take a cumulative case approach to this idea of a beast and Nero and Domitian, how other writers from antiquity refer to Nero and Domitian as beast-like people, then you can kind of connect all the dots and come to an educated guess here. Only a guess. It's only speculation, but it's actually really educated guessing. I wouldn't even really call it guessing at this point. It's just really good ideas. Now there's other theories, of course, about six. It's the number of a man we hear. You know, man was made on the sixth day according to the Genesis account. And so it is kind of in that sense endowed with a bit of nefarious mystery, these numbers, three sixes together and 666. So I guess in that sense, it would have been kind of a quote spooky number, but not in the sense of, you know, you get it on your credit card or you get it on your driver's license or you tally up your cost at the grocery store and it's $6. It doesn't bother me at all because nobody gets freaked out by 616 and there's evidence, you know, if you're going to get freaked out by 666, you should get freaked out by 616. It's just not meant to convey those sorts of modern connotations that we've given it. Does that help answer the question?
Yeah, I think you did a great job talking about that. And it's important to me, to explain to people, and I think your book does a great job of this, is just because there is a historical background to something doesn't mean that all the mystery is gone. or that, you know, we have now laid bare this thing that the Christians have been struggling to come up with for a very long time. It's these things aren't intended to turn you off of the text. They're intended to pull you deeper into the text. And so I think that what so many people have, in our quest to just understand something and mark it off our list as done, we have the desire to then say, okay, now that I have this, I have no further questions. And I think that identifying that meaning, that number points us to Nero, isn't necessarily a complete explanation of what Satan is doing and what the kingdom of darkness is going to be doing, but it does show us for sure what this looked like for the early Christian. It tells us, hey, this is what we're dealing with, and this is what's going on. And just because Nero died doesn't mean that the spiritual war that we're involved in is gone. But it does, I think, it pulls the book of Revelation out of the future and into the present. And it gives me, I love one of the major elements of your book that I found so helpful is to focus on the lamb and not the beast. That it is this idea that this is a book about the revelation of Jesus. This is not a book about the revelation of the Antichrist or the revelation of the plagues that are coming. But I know we're hard up on time here, and I've taken up a bunch of your time. But I just want to thank you for writing it, and you have given me loads to think about and an enjoyable kind of thinking about it, not like, this is no fun. But I've learned a lot from your book, and I would recommend it to folks to get the conversation going, because so often you'll find, and I'm going to put my preacher hat on here for a second, is that Christians are so fast to throw sticks and stones at one another when we don't line up exactly on an issue. And people are so afraid at times to share their thoughts or what they're thinking about, partially because we're not talking with each other, we're talking at each other. And we're viewing one another as threats. And the scripture is not intended to be a threat to you. It's intended to draw you closer to Jesus. It's the word of God. The Spirit gave us this, and you should be enjoying it and loving what you're reading. So this book will not take away all the mystery of Revelation, but what it will do is equip you to better read the book of Revelation. And so, Dr. Halstead, you did awesome. Thank you for giving this book to us. And where would you like people to go to purchase your stuff? Do you have a place that you want them to go, or what would you recommend?
Yeah, wherever you like to buy books, that's where I would recommend going. Whether it's your local bookstore, Amazon, or Barnes & Noble, whatever, it doesn't matter. It's wherever. And if you do like the book, maybe consider leaving a review on Amazon. All the computer tech savvy people tell me, yeah, that really helps get the word out if people leave reviews and whatnot. So if you don't mind doing that, I really, really appreciate it. And ultimately, yeah, I would just want to echo, piggyback on what you said. Like, I don't have the final word on Revelation. I don't confess to at all. And if we see Revelation as kind of a project to understand and to solve, I think we would probably miss the point of Revelation, because I think what Revelation is wanting us to do is to mold and craft our imaginations for how we too can live out the life of the Lamb in a world full of beastly things and realities, right? And I think people might fear that what I've done in the book is just put everything in the first century and there's no more application in the 21st. That would not be true. I mean, a careful reading of my book will show that by putting it in the first century, it actually opens up avenues for fresh application in the 21st. You know, Nero all of a sudden becomes more of an archetypal figure that has, I guess you could say, manifestations in every era of church history, you know. And the hope that we have is that one day God will, through Jesus, destroy the works of the enemy. And that's what John foresaw at the end of his letter of Revelation, is that, he conceived of the ultimate evil as the Roman Empire, because that was the ultimate evil of the day. And so he sees Jesus totally destroying that through these images of the beast. But for us, you know, we anticipate the day when evil is eradicated, the beast is destroyed through the word of Jesus Christ. And so my hope is just to help people keep the hope on the Jesus salvation plan that he's going to bring about, But it's also to remember that this is not the revelation of Satan. This is the revelation of Jesus Christ. And he's our focus. Any other focus gets us off beat. And we want to maintain our allegiance to the Lamb by focusing on the Lamb, knowing that it's the slain Lamb who will defeat the monstrous beast. Indeed, he already has, and he will one day consummate that victory on our behalf for all of us. So that's our hope. That's why it's good news.
Can I get an amen?